Hello, Quotation Rotation people, and let me tell you something. Welcome to the inaugural episode of the Retro Rankings Podcast, where we strive to add just one more gaming-related podcast to the already crowded landscape. We probably already have at least 23 better choices in listening to this one, but hey, you're here. So grab a beer or some other alcoholic beverage, whatever you want, and strap in for what will probably be a train wreck for your ear holes. Now you're probably asking yourself this very important question. What the fuck is a quotation rotation? Well, maybe you already know, and that's why you're here. And I'm sorry for that. But if you do not know what quotation rotation is, let me tell you, and I'll apologize in advance for this. Quotation rotation, or Portorota for you simple folk, started as a YouTube channel dedicated to drinking and gaming and all kinds of reviews, and the occasional vidcast and game challenges with co-hosts. The main thing we tried to keep consistent is the ever-rotating drink selections with every new episode, even though some of us have a preference to keep the booze the same. But that being said, and I will announce this at the top of every episode of Retro Rankings going forward, I'll tell you that today, I'm drinking a icy cold Coors Light. Oh. Anyway, back to what, you're just going to have to trust me. Not being on video, you're just going to have to believe that I'm drinking a Coors Light and not a LaCroix or something. Anyway, back to what Portorota is. Since I started the channel over a year ago, it has recently split into different channels, and each one focuses on the things that the original did, but with their own, you know, theme for the channels. The original Quotation Rotation channel mostly focuses on playing and talking about video games along with a drink or two. Quotation Rotation Reviews focuses on food, goods, and gaming reviews while imbibing. And License to Drink features myself and Main Quest podcast host Keith, who just also happens to be my brother, play games that involve driving some sort of motorized vehicle while we, you guessed it, get drunk. The best thing about License to Drink is sometimes you'll get an episode that is complete nonsense, as we film multiple episodes in a day, and the later episodes have us pretty much three sheets to the wind. So it makes things interesting, to say the least. Anyway, please go check those out. Those channels are on YouTube. Again, they are Quotation Rotation, Quotation Rotation Reviews, and License to Drink. Oh, also, follow us on Instagram at Quotation Rotation TV. Twitter at Portorota TV, and Facebook at Quotation Rotation TV. Now, this intro episode, you're going to get all that stuff right now at the top. Going forward, you're not going to hear all that stuff. It's going to be summed up at the end. But unfortunately, it's also going to be summed up at the end of this one as well. So you're just going to have to deal with it. Oh, before I forget, I'm also on Twitch as Quotation Rotation TV as well. There's no set schedule, but if you follow the socials that I just rambled off, or the socius, get used to that. You're going to be hearing me say socius a lot. You're going to get like a day notice on those, and then you'll get a day of notice. And then that's it. That was your last warning. You're not going to get any more warnings. So it's fun to come and watch and shoot the shit while live, you know. But if you miss it and the streams, you know, they'll get uploaded to YouTube after the fact on the Quotation Rotation channel, but they're edited, so you might miss out on some awkward things that happen live. But anyway, I encourage you to watch on Twitch for the director's cut, so to speak. Or would that be the uncut? That would be the director's uncut, but I didn't cut it. It's still my vision. You know what? Never mind. Whatever the fuck. I'm sure you get the point. Anyway, let's get to the moist, juicy meat attached to all this fat. I thought I would start off this podcast with an 8-bit bang, with presenting probably the most mainstream and popular retro console of all time, and quite frankly, just keeping it vanilla and safe. And that's with the Nintendo Entertainment System, and today we're ranking the top NES games according to me. Yep, that's what I said, top 7. Why 7, you say? Well, because 10 is a little too much, and 5 is too convenient of a number. There are people that are like, here are my top, whatever the fuck. And then they get to the end, and they're like, oh, but I have honorable mentions. So, like, instead of a top 10, they just gave you a top 12. So, I'm not going to be one of those people. I'm telling you straight up, and it's not calculus or statistics. I am basically giving you 5 plus 2. That is my top 5 plus 2 honorables, basically. Only I'm literally calling it top 7, because that's just what it is. It's just what it fucking is. And that will be the format of all these episodes going forward. Top 7. And I suppose they can't always be vanilla and safe, no matter how vanilla and safe the ranking topic may be, like this one is today. Because these are my rankings. Most will be in unanimity, some controversial. But in the end, it's meant to be informative and, at best, spark discussion. Oh shit, fuck, I forgot to give you my meat, my moist, juicy meat. I was talking about that, I was going to give it to you. I'm going to give it to you right now. Here it is. Let's begin this episode of the top 7 NES games. So, with today's rankings, the format is going to be that you're going to get the history of the game, story of the game, the gameplay, and why it's on my list. And some games, as we go down the list, especially as we get to number 1, are it's going to be a little bit longer. Some are going to be abridged. I mean, you'll understand when we get there. But let's go ahead and roll out with 7. Bionic Commando. Bionic Commando originally released in Japan as Top Secret. Actually, it was once called Hitler's Resurrection Top Secret, and we'll touch on that later. It was an arcade game originally produced and released by Capcom in 1987, and it is the first obscure installment in the Bionic Commando series of action platformer games. Directed by Takuro Fujiwara, it was later released for several home computers and released for the NES in 1988, which it was kind of like a pseudo sequel, the home versions of it, to the arcade Bionic Commando. It wasn't like an exact replicate of it. The game is included in Capcom Classics Collection for the PS2 and the Xbox. The Bionic Commando series consists of, as of 2017, 5 games and 2 remakes. The first one was released in 1992 for the Game Boy. The second remake, titled Bionic Commando Rearmed, was released in 2008 for the PlayStation Network and Xbox Live Arcade. The plot of the original Japanese release revolved around an attempt on part of neo-Nazis to revive Hitler. Hence, Hitler's Resurrection. And then the top secret title. For all of the releases, all references to Nazism in text and imagery were removed. The Nazis here are referred to as the Bads. That's B-A-D-D-S. Though the backstory in the American version's manual referred to them as the Naz. Oh, gotta love that translation of game text in the 80s. The Imperial Army swastika insignia was then changed to one resembling an eagle. And the leader of the villains, originally called Weissman in the Japanese version, is renamed Kilt. In addition to graphical changes, the difficulty of the game was rebalanced, and some of the areas were made less difficult because, you know, the Japanese thought us Americans were gaming pussies. In the game, the player has to explore 13 areas and 7 neutral areas and obtain the necessary equipment to progress. The outward appearance of the overworld map makes it appear that you can go to any area you want, and maybe skip an area. But there's a method to this madness here, and some areas have requirements to play that are obtained in others. You play as Lad Spencer, or Rad, depending upon what old school gaming school you graduated from, where translations matter. A commando equipped with a bionic arm featuring a grappling gun. Rad, we're just going to call him Lad. That allowed him to pull himself forward or swing from the ceiling. As such, the series is one of few instances of a platform game in which the player cannot jump. To cross gaps or climb ledges, you must use the bionic arm. And you have to save the princess. No, actually, there's no saving a princess in this game. You have to save Super Joe, who was taken captive by Master D, who is basically Hitler. And that's not so super if you get your bitch ass captured by the bad guys. If I have opinion about anything, like, he should just be called Joe. Anyway, why is this game on my list? Not only is it interesting gameplay of using the bionic arm to get through the game, and that's the one of the main reasons why it falls on number 7 on my list, is that mechanic, but it has the single best what the holy fuck goddamn shit kind of moment in retro gaming history.
No! Hold up! Time out! Time out! Y'all take a chill! You need to cool that shit out!
You know, when playing Bionic Commando back in 1988 and not knowing a thing about its recent history at that time, or the Japanese counterpart, I mean, it was a different time back then. I mean, you didn't have the internet, you still had fax machines, pages were kind of a thing. You had the cell phones and the cars with all the wires and shit, but I mean, you got your news from the news on the TV and the newspaper, and shit like this wasn't exactly just prevalent in those publications. The player was met with Master D looking a lot like Hitler. I mean, that's because it is Hitler, like I've said. And being 10 or 11 at the time and having Hitler in a Nintendo game, the same company that gave us Mario and Link and a port of their arcade classic Donkey Kong, they just put motherfucking Hitler in a game. Well, they didn't. Capcom did, but you know what I'm getting at. It was mind-blowing, pun intended. And that ending, nothing felt better than killing Hitler and watching his face zoomed in and exploding. And you know what? It still feels fucking good to this day.
Shit, Negro! That's all you had to say!
Anyway, the mechanic of swinging around takes some getting used to, and once you're used to it, it does feel kind of good. It does make some boss fights a little challenging, and that's not a bad thing. You just have to learn to be proficient with it. The graphics are your standard NES fare, nothing outstanding, but there were worse by 1988.
Renegade!
And it has quite the signature soundtrack that, if you click and vibrate your tongue fast enough to recreate it for someone, any other fan of Bionic Commando will know exactly what those sounds are coming out of your fucking mouth. So anyway, that's why Bionic Commando is my number 7 NES game. Time to imbibe on a sip of Coors Light. I don't sip, I gulp. I take one big gulp. Anyway, let's move on.
6.
Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. Mike Tyson's Punch-Out, or simply Punch-Out, for those who prefer the Klethith re-release, is a boxing sports video game for the NES developed and published by Nintendo in 1987 and directed by Genyo Takada. And yes, there have been the re-releases and sequels since. Interesting bit of history regarding the sequels. After the release of Punch-Out, Chrome Studios Melbourne, or KSM, began developing an official sequel starring Mike Tyson with his manager Don King, and it was originally going to be titled Mike Tyson's Intergalactic Power Punch. The game was supposed to take the series into outer space, where Tyson would participate in an intergalactic boxing tournament against various space aliens. The game's production ran into immediate trouble, however, following Tyson's 1991 incarceration for the alleged rape of Desiree Washington. Being changed the name of Tyson's character to Mark Tyler and modified King, but did literally change Tyson's actual in-game character sprite. Nintendo saw the game and disliked it, refusing to publish it due to lack of quality. Eventually, ASC Games published the title, and the game was released on the NES as Power Punch 2. despite the fact there was never a first Power Punch game.
That is the stupidest thing I ever heard of. Jesus Christ.
But anyway, back to Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. It features a boxer known as Little Mac, finding his way through the ranks of the World Video Boxing Association. If you're keen on abbreviations, that is the WVBA, BTW. After facing a series of cartoonish and sometimes politically incorrect characters in three main circuits, with one hidden one called Another World Circuit, the goal is to win a final dream fight against Mike Tyson. There isn't much of a story here. That's pretty much the story. That's all you're going to get. As far as the gameplay, Little Mac resorts to a repertoire that consists of left and right jabs and punches, an uppercut, and he can block attacks as well by dodging and ducking his opponents. As Little Mac progresses through the roster, sometimes twice, the opponents have a moveset and patterns that are unique to them, and you have to learn them in order to beat them. The uppercut can only be used once the player earns a star, which is typically accomplished by counter-punching the opponent directly before or after certain attacks are launched, and tops out at 3 stars. Little Mac also has a heart container, which decreases upon being hit, blocking a punch or throwing a punch that the opponent dodges or blocks. When the counter decreases to 0, Little Mac temporarily turns pink and appears to be exhausted. And that leaves Little Mac vulnerable to attacks, but he can still dodge and duck and block. At this point, Mac can regain some hearts by avoiding the opponent's punches. He immediately loses all of his hearts upon being knocked down, but can regain some by getting back up. A bout can end by knockout, KO, if a fighter is unable to get up within 10 seconds after being knocked down. Or by technical knockout, TKO, if a fighter is knocked down 3 times in 1 round, or by decision, if the bout lasts 3 full rounds without a clear winner. In order to win by decision, the player must accumulate higher than a certain point total by punching the opponent and or knocking him down, and it varies from one opponent to the next. However, some bouts cannot be won in this manner, and will automatically result in a loss for the player if the opponent is not knocked out. Mac can only get up 2 times during any one bout, so if he is knocked down a 3rd cumulative time, he will be unable to rise and thus lose by KO. For the fight with Tyson, this just brings me anxiety even thinking about having to talk about it, but for the first 90 seconds, Tyson will throw nothing but one-hit knockdown uppercuts. If he connects with Little Mac, Mac instantly goes down. The player can block the move while they have full health, but they will still take a large amount of damage, so blocking isn't really that practical. Tyson also has an unpredictable and seemingly random moveset, which sets this fight apart from the prior fights, and timing of his blows, making those knockdown uppercuts hard to negotiate. Afterwards, he will throw more manageable blows that do less damage. Little Mac can get a star by simply slamming Tyson with a head punch when Tyson blinks both of his eyes, which is to notate that he's going to do a ripoff of Piston Honda's Piston Rush. The main concern for Little Mac is Tyson's lightning jabs, which can come out quick and overall. I'll just say fuck it. Fuck this. I don't want to talk about it anymore. Simply put, if you want to consider Mike Tyson a boss fight, this is like the single most hardest and rage-inducing boss fight in retro video game history. That being said, why does it make it on my list of within the top 7? I mean, the game is fun. It's so much fun that sometimes you forget that it's technically a sports title. Probably because of the ridiculous but fun-to-fight characters with their giant sprites, which were awesome to see at the time. And they kind of still are to this day. The game just looks good. And it feels good. It controls very well. And it's a title that forces you to learn in order to progress. Except for that Tyson fight. But there isn't any other game that makes you feel as fucking glorious finishing it like you do when putting Tyson down. Which I couldn't do at the age of 11. The one time I did it, I was in my late 20s.
Congratulations!
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 Yeah, once, because fuck that fight. This game is super legit up until then, and that's why it makes number 6 on my list. Take a drink, everyone. Because it's time for
5.
Metroid. Metroid is an action platformer developed and produced by Nintendo and directed by Satoru Okada. It was released in 1987. Even though we didn't know it until we finished playing it, Metroid cemented the main character, Samus Aran, as... spoiler alert! One of the earliest female protagonists in video game history. Both a critical and commercial success, Metroid spawned sequels for the Game Boy, Game Boy Advance, Super Nintendo, and spin-offs like the Metroid Prime series and also a pseudo-remake in Zero Mission. Mother Brain also became a household term in the late 80s, especially when you were talking about a friend's mom during a sleepover. Oh, the good old days. Anyway, it's the year 2000... or 2003, or maybe 2005. You know, it's not really clear. Don't send me emails. It's the year 2000X, and the space pirates attack a Galactic Federation-owned space research vessel and seize samples of Metroid creatures. They are parasitic life forms of planet SR388. Metroids can latch onto any organism and drain its life energy to kill it. The plan is to replicate the Metroids by exposing them to beta rays and then using them as biological weapons. Eventually, the Galactic Federation finds the space pirates' base on the planet Zabaz.
It happened on one of them zippity doo dah days. Now, that's the kind of day when you can't open your mouth without a song jump right out of it. Zippity doo dah, zippity a. My, oh my, what a wonderful day.
Zabada. After a failed attack on the space pirates, the Federation decides to send a bounty hunter named Samus Aran into the pirates' base and to destroy Mother Brain, the biomechanical life form that controls the space pirates, their fortress, their defenses. Samus lands on the surface of Zebedee Duda and explores the planet, traveling through the planet's caverns. Along the way, she comes across enemies Kraid and Ridley. By the way, Ridley's rumored to be named after famed director Ridley Scott, so there you go. And on the way to Mother Brain is when she meets these cast of characters. It is at the end of the game that Samus' power suit flashes away to reveal that he's a woman, baby.
Let me ask you a question, and be honest.
Who?
Do I make you horny?
Randy?
Do I make you horny, baby? Yeah, do I?
Oh, Terminus! Oh, look at that! Oh, Terminus! Oh, I've got over!
Metroid provided one of the first highly non-linear game experiences at the time, seemingly combining the likes of Super Mario Bros. Side-scrolling platforming with The Legend of Zelda's exploration adventuring across 5 different areas. Oh, and of course, it's a platform shooter as well, making it quite the well-rounded game. And it's since become part of a well-known genre of gaming known as Metroidvania. I'm sure you don't need any help finding out where the Vania part of that comes from. Anyway, Samus begins with a very limited amount of power-ups and must explore the large areas to achieve the next locked or unreachable area. Because the game world is presented in one multi-screened level, there are often times that an area can be reached before they're meant to be, and if you know the game well enough, that's not an issue. Among the power-ups that are included in the game are the Morph Ball, which allows Samus to curl into a ball and roll into tunnels, the Bomb, which can only be used while in ball form and can open hidden floor and wall paths, and the screw attack. somersaulting move that destroys enemies in its path. With the lack of a timer and scoring, the game really gives the player that feel of open exploration in its nonlinear presentation. So, Metroid makes it on my list because it's pretty much a well-rounded game. A mix of other games in recent years at the time, Metroid gives the player a nonlinear open exploration feel while being a platformer and a shooter all in one tight package. It is
oh so tight.
It taught players that they needed to achieve certain objectives to advance, even if it means you have to backtrack to succeed. The graphics are typical NES graphics, though at the time seeing the enemies Kraid, Ridley, and Mother Brain were quite impressive. The Metroid soundtrack has also become one of the most memorable in video game history. And Nintendo set out to stop some dude from saving some chick and instead, unbeknownst to the player until the very end, sent this cool-ass chick out to save the motherfucking galaxy. And that was pretty dope, breaking a tired trope. Well, that rhymes. That wasn't much of a trope back then, but it's become a trope now. Anyway, that's why Metroid makes my number 5. I need to quench my thirst with a Coors Light. Time to move along. Mega Man 2. The cover still sucks, but not as bad as the cover for the Mega Man game, the first one. It's still legit, not that good. However, Mega Man 2 as a game itself that you play is way better than the first one. An action platformer, this sequel was developed by Capcom and directed by Akira Kitamura and released for the NES in 1988. Mega Man 2 is the best-selling Mega Man game with more than 1.5 million copies sold. Critics praised its audio, visuals, and gameplay as an improvement over the first. Many publications rank Mega Man 2 as the best game in the series, and maybe one of the greatest video games of all time. Well, I'm going to have to probably disagree with that. Hot take! It has also been re-released on several other consoles and made available on mobile phones. It has a remake, 9 more sequels, the franchise itself has spun off multiple times. In the year 2000... Oh my god... In the year 2000X, we're just going to say 2000X, or the first decade of the 21st century, I'm not going Metroid on this one. A super robot named Mega Man was created by Dr. Light to stop the mysterious evil genius Dr. Wily. However, 1 year after his defeat, Dr. Wily returns with 8 of his own combat robots to challenge Mega Man. Mega Man, learning this, sets out to defeat the 8 robot masters which Dr. Wily has created, having to traverse their respective stages first. After having defeated these robots, Dr. Wily fled in his flying saucer to his fortress, the Wily Castle. Eventually, Mega Man made his way to the heart of the castle, where he once again fought the 8 robot masters as well as the Wily machine. Dr. Wily fled Mega Man once again, this time escaping into a cave underneath the castle. Here, that's when Mega Man confronted him. Dr. Wily seemingly turned into an alien. After a fierce battle between Mega Man and the alien, it is revealed that the alien is actually a hologram controlled by Dr. Wily. The evil doctor, having no means of escape, begs Mega Man for mercy, and the world was rid of evil once again. As I throw my finger up in the air, you are Mega Man, and you are set out with your Mega Buster. No, it's not a gun. Don't believe that fucking artwork. To defeat the robot masters Metal Man, Air Man, Bubble Man, Quick Man, Crash Man, Flash Man, Heat Man, and Wood Man. Each robot master features a unique weapon and a stage related to their weapon's power. For example, Air Man shoots small tornadoes and is fought in a sky-themed level, while Wood Man can use a shield of leaves and is found in a forest-themed stage. After defeating a boss, their signature weapon becomes available to Mega Man as an upgrade to his Mega Buster. The robot masters have weaknesses to the weapons of other certain robot masters. Therefore, choosing a proper order to play the levels is key to a quick boss defeat after having already gone through, sometimes, a pretty difficult stage. After completing certain stages, Mega Man receives a special item as well. These items create platforms that allow Mega Man to access areas that he otherwise could not. After defeating the 8 robot masters, the player proceeds to Dr. Wily's fortress, which consists of 6 levels that are played linearly, and you cannot choose your own adventure here. And in a copy of the first Mega Man, you're required to fight each robot master a second time in Dr. Wily's fortress. However, these battles take place in a single room this time around, with teleportation devices that lead to each robot master. The devices can be entered in any order. They're not labeled, but that's fine, since you already have the powers obtained from having gone through the game once before. So you just get into a room, you see who the robot master is, you quickly load up your Mega Buster with the weapon they're weak against, and you're good to go. Once the bosses are defeated again, the player must fight Dr. Wily. Mega Man 2 features a few gameplay changes from the original Mega Man. A new item, the Energy Tank, allows a player to refill Mega Man's health at any time. Also introduced is the password system. After defeating each robot master, a password is displayed, allowing the player to return to that particular point in the game. The password stores the particular list of completed robot masters, as well as the number of accumulated energy tanks. Unlike the first game, Mega Man 2 does not feature a score counter, and the player is unable to return to robot master levels once it's completed. Mega Man 2 is on my list because it is the perfect example of taking something that was on paper a good idea and executing it kind of shitty. So despite shit sales, you get a green light, and you go at it again, and you improve upon it greatly for the sequel. The graphics, music, and gameplay is vastly superior to its predecessor. It takes the open level, select, choose your own adventure style of gameplay that was great about the original and ups the ante. And provided, this concept allows the player to figure out which boss's weapon is most effective against another boss that gives the best configuration of play possible. Or you can take this concept in the other direction and make the game more difficult if you live for anguish.
Complicated fellow, isn't he?
But the controls are tight as well for this outing, so that is just another plus to add to the reasons as to why Mega Man 2 is number 4 on my list. Grab your beverage, folks. It's time for a gulp. Refreshing. DuckTales. Yeah, it's pretty much Capcom or Nintendo, it seems, for my top 7 list, because DuckTales is yet another Capcom joint. It is a platform game based on the Disney cartoon of the same name and directed by Tokiro Fujiwara, yes, the same guy that did Bionic Commando, and the team behind it comprised mostly of the same team behind Mega Man games as well, so it's no wonder at this point. Anyway, the game was released for the NES in 1989 and ported to the Game Boy in 1990. It spawned a now expensive physical cartridge sequel titled DuckTales 2 and went on to be ported across multiple platforms and even got a remake in DuckTales Remastered in 2013. And by that time, since Metroidvania was now a game style, HD Remake is actually classified as such. It is not an action platformer. It is now the remake of DuckTales, a Metroidvania-style game. In DuckTales, you're Scrooge McDuck, the richest duck in the world. Well, maybe. Flitart Glomgold may beg to differ. And as Scrooge goes out to hunt down more treasure, he must stop Flintheart from doing the very same thing. Scrooge encounters a cast of characters from the TV show as he visits such storied locales as the African mines, the Amazon, the Himalayas, the moon, and Transylvania. And that's pretty much it as far as the story goes. I mean, it's a Disney game from the 80s. Can't expect anything more complicated. This isn't overly complicated either as far as the gameplay goes. It's quite overall a simplistic game. Scrooge can jump by pressing A, and he can use his cane as a weapon to defeat enemies or strike objects using the B button. And you will find a need at times to swing at and move some objects. The cane can also be used as a pogo stick to jump higher. That's by pressing A, then B plus down. And that's pretty much it for the controls. Aside from that, there is a wide variety of helpful NPCs, and there's also enemy characters throughout the 5 levels here. And much like Mega Man, the levels can be played in any order, but that doesn't necessarily mean one should be played before another. It isn't advantageous in any way, though some levels are easier than others. A boss guards the treasure that Scrooge seeks at the end of each level. There are also two hidden treasures, a golden ring in the African Mines level, and a golden mirror in the Moon level. Upon finishing all five levels, the player is directed back to Transylvania for the boss fight. And if you find along the way that you can't access something locked away within a level that requires something from another level you played, you can most certainly revisit any level you wish to complete that task. I mean, that's DuckTales right there. It's not complicated. It's non-linear. It's a decent story-driven translation of what was and is, by historical standards, one of the best Disney animated television series of all time. And aside from colorful, pleasant character sprites and decent graphics, especially when Underground are inside, not outside, they completely missed the boat on background graphics. But anyway, the music is also catchy, and most importantly, the game is just a fucking joy to play. It's just challenging enough to find secrets and yet simple enough in their executions that any completionist would have no issue 100%ing this game. And of all the Capcom-produced NES titles based on Disney-animated properties of the time, this one outshines them all. Sorry, Chip and Dale's Rescue Rangers, but that's why DuckTales is number 3 on my list. Do I have enough cold brew to get me through the other two? There I go again with my rhyming. I think I should write a rap song after I'm done with this podcast.
Surprise, motherfucker.
Supplies, motherfucker. Some fries, motherfucker. Disguise, motherfucker. Some pies, motherfucker. All rise, motherfucker. Wrong size, motherfucker. First prize, motherfucker. Hard eyes, motherfucker. Rude eyes, motherfucker.
2.
The Legend of Zelda. I mean, look, I could do a single podcast on The Legend of Zelda alone. It is by far my favorite video game series of all time. Anybody who knows me knows this. And there will be episodes dedicated to ranking everything from best Zelda console titles to worst NPCs in Zelda games. It's inevitable. It's going to happen because I fucking love this series. But for today, let me just point you in the direction of another podcast where you can hear me discuss The Legend of Zelda for the NES probably longer than it needs to be. Head on over to the Main Quest podcast and queue up episode 23, because it hits hard on this title. Keith and I discuss it probably for about 3 times as long as we intended. That way I have an excuse not to go overboard here. And with that being said, The Legend of Zelda, or the Hyrule Fantasy The Legend of Zelda in Japan, is a high fantasy action adventure RPG hybrid video game that was developed and published by Nintendo and released in 1987 for the NES. With a kick-ass gold cartridge, it was created and directed by the man, the myth, the legend, Shigeru Miyamoto. It is the second most popular Nintendo gaming franchise right after Super Mario Bros., and has since gone on to spawn countless sequels, handheld games, remakes, ports, spin-offs, crossovers, a couple CD-based titles we don't talk about here, an animated cartoon, and 80 serial fan-made films, and one of the most complicated and convoluted fucking timelines in video game history. Okay. I'm stopping with the history now because it can dig oh so deep. Let's just get on to the story. Link is a fated hero charged by Impa, Princess Zelda's nursemaid, with saving the land of Hyrule with his sword and a shield and a seemingly bottomless pouch of other items at his ready. Using all this equipment that is gathered over the course of his adventure, Link explores a vast overworld and puzzling dungeons on a quest to save Princess Zelda from the clutches of the evil Ganon. Link can be as strong as he needs to be to face Ganon, depending upon the choices he makes on his journey, but still must seek to collect 8 Triforce of Wisdom fragments before proceeding to Spectacle Rock at the peak of Death Mountain for that final battle, where upon defeating Ganon, Link will rescue Zelda and obtain the Triforce of Power Ganon also had in his possession. It goes deeper, but that's the Cliff's Notes version. Is Cliff's Notes even still a thing, or am I really starting to date myself the more I talk? Since the game has mostly a pseudo-overhead style view, Link can move in any direction, up, down, left, and right. A is for your sword, and B is your selected special item, including assigning potions to drink to regain health. Link is not able to jump, which makes for traversing some areas a tad bit of a challenge. The map of Hyrule is a grid of varying terrain that Link can explore and travel to nearly every corner, except you'll require items such as a raft or a ladder to reach certain areas. Some paths are further blocked by overpowered enemies that Link will have little chance of defeating without upgraded weapons and plenty of health. At full health, Link's sword is able to shoot a magic beam across the screen, which is critical to have most times as his sword length isn't exactly the best. It's kind of short, like a teeny-weeny little peeny.
Hey! Excuse me, princess. Excuse me, princess. Well, excuse me, princess. Hey! Excuse me, princess. Well, excuse me. Excuse me, princess. Excuse me, princess. Excuse me, princess.
He will use bombs to blow up secret walls and some enemies who can only be killed with them. You'll need arrows to put down some enemies as well, and you'll require rupees to help buy new items or upgrades to them along the way. After initially completing the game, one can begin its more difficult version, referred to as the Second Quest, which alters many locations, secrets, and includes entirely distinct dungeons and stronger enemies as well. Although more difficult replays were not unique to Zelda, few games offered completely different levels upon the second playthrough. By starting a new file with the name entered as Zelda, the mode can be accessed without needing to beat the game first. I'd call you a cheater if you do that, but you know, you're bypassing the main quest for a more difficult version, so I guess I'll let it slide, because you're going right for the good, meaty, hard stuff instead of getting through that easy stuff first. So go have at it, Todd. So, of all the games in the NES library, why is Zelda on my list? I mean, do I really have to explain myself? The Legend of Zelda is by no means a masterpiece by today's standards, but it was vastly different from most 8-bit games of the time, and set a precedent for these hybrid high-fantasy action-adventure RPG games that would follow, including within the Zelda series itself, of course. The graphics are nothing to write home about here, but, and they weren't at the time either, but they served their purpose in allowing for the near-free exploration of the game provided. There are 10 tracks used in the game, with most being sounds and sound bites, like, you know, the whistle or the secret sound. With 3, maybe 4, being considered actual songs. Those would be the intro, the overworld, and the dungeon music. However, Death Mountain does have its own music as well, but it's kind of like a shorter loop than what you would get with the other dungeons. And the ending is best described as like twinkle noises, so that's not really a song either, but anyway, let's just say it has 3 songs, and despite having those 3 songs, 2 of which consistently repeat throughout the game, that is the overworld and the dungeons, you can tell even the almost orchestrated nature of these songs that just help boost the feeling of being on some grand adventure. And those themes have gone on to be reimagined and part of a larger universe of songs that are some of the greatest of any gaming franchise. And these are just the abridged reasons as to why The Legend of Zelda comes in at number 2. Alright folks, we're headed for number 1. I think I got 2 good gulps left, so that's good. 1 now, and 1 at the end. I think I took more in than I needed to. Oh boy. Alright. Pull your shit together, Paul. It's time for number 1. Super Mario Brothers 3. This one was inevitable. I'm pretty sure that 99.9% of any best of NES games list will have this at number 1. Anyone that provides such a list and doesn't rank Mario Bros. 3 at number 1 probably never played the fucking game. The original Super Mario Bros., released in 1985, set the groundwork for platformers for the next 35 years. Super Mario Bros. Broke that mold then and said, "Hold my beer." Or, I mean, whatever they were holding in 1990. Was it Probably like a Seagram's. Yeah, it was probably Seagram's.
What would you like?
Well, I don't know. What do I feel like?
Why not try something you've never had before?
Is that a line?
No, it's a drink. Seagram's Golden Wine Cooler. It's wet, it's dry, it's new, and it's Seagram's.
You sound like a commercial.
You're buying it?
The drink? Yeah, but not the line.
It's a start.
New Seagram's Golden Wine Cooler. It's wet and it's dry.
Yeah, anyway. So it released in 1990 in North America, which was a whole 16 months after Japan got it for the Famicom. Super Mario Bros. 3 is an action platformer that was, of course, developed and published by Nintendo and, yep, directed by that Miyamoto guy. And by the way, I just want to say this. I want to give a credit where credit is due to Takashi Tezuka as well for this and The Legend of Zelda. He's kind of the Jack Kirby to Miyamoto Stanley. So, but anyway, like with Zelda, there will be many episodes of Retro Rankings devoted to ranking Mario shit. So let's keep the deep dives reserved for those more specific episodes. I will only say that I can safely assume that everyone knows what Mario has become since the first game, and post NES. Outside of gaming consoles, there's film, television, comics, certain CD games we don't talk about here. I mean, he was more popular than Mickey Mouse at one time. Even my grandma knew who Mario was, and I'm sure her grandma did too, and she was 6 feet under. And after the refreshing yet what-the-fuck moment that was Super Mario Bros. 2 North America, Super Mario Bros. 3 was basically Miyamoto's lovely apology letter to Mario fans. Even the ones in Japan that got that clone of the first for a sequel. As far as the Mushroom Kingdom goes, peace was returned to the Mushroom Kingdom, thanks to the efforts of Mario and Luigi, assuming this was after the Japanese Mario 2, since the US Mario 2 was in Subcon, and spoiler alert! It was a dream! Oh, and spoiler alert! Mario Bros. 3 is a play. Anyway, Bowser, he sent his own 7 children, known as Koopalings, which are Larry, Morton, Wendy, Iggy, Roy, Lemmy, and Ludwig, to the other countries of the Mushroom World. The Mushroom Kingdom forms a gateway to these lands, and the Koopalings have stolen respective royal magic wands of the 7 kings, using them to transform the kings into various helpless creatures. Mario and Luigi vow to go and stop the Koopalings' mischief and change the kings back to their normal form. At the end of each world, Mario and Luigi fight one of the Koopalings, and after the fight's over, they retrieve the wand from the Koopaling, return it to the king. King goes back to normal. And while the brothers are out on their adventure, Bowser kidnaps Princess Toadstool, of course, you know, because he's got to. It's just like, you know, it's a little part of the... And takes her to his castle in Darkland. You know, the only time he doesn't, by the way, if you pick up a Mario title where Princess Peach is a playable character, she's not going to get kidnapped.
Thanks, Captain Obvious.
The brothers go to Darkland and fight Bowser. After defeating Bowser, they save the princess and restore peace once again. Super Mario Bros. 3 plays similarly to that of Super Mario Bros. With several additions. The game features a world map where the player can choose which path to take and which level to play. The toad houses and spade panels are also found on the world map, and halfway through each world, Mario or Luigi will enter a fortress where they fight Boom Boom as kind of like a mid-world boss. At the end of each world, they enter the world's airship, where one of the 7 Koopalings is fought. The first player controls Mario, while the second player controls his brother Luigi, with the two players taking turns. New moves, including being able to pick up an object and kick it in the slope slide, which allows Mario or Luigi to get down on that ass and slide down a hill. And that move has, you know, been carried over into the future Mario games as well. The Fire Flower returns in this game, where it acts as it does in Super Mario Bros., allowing Mario and Luigi to transform into their fire forms and shoot fireballs from their fingertips. Several new power-ups are also introduced, including the Super Leaf, a leaf power-up that transforms Mario and Luigi into their raccoon forms, allowing them to fly into the sky, and the Hammer Suit, which transforms the brothers into their hammer forms, letting them throw hammers at enemies. And that suit is fucking awesome to me. You can also crouch down, and that shell protects you from hits. Love it. Love it.
Oh, oh, oh. You know what I'm talking about. Oh.
We also had such fantastic items as the P-Wing that gives Mario or Luigi unlimited flying power for that level they are playing. However, once you complete that level, the brothers retain just the Super Leaf type power, and that's the power they have for the next level. Also, the Warp Whistle. Does the sweet music it makes sound familiar? The Warp Whistle warps you to any level of your choice depending upon the set of levels that it's used in. If it is used in World 1, the player can warp to Worlds 2, 3, or 4. If it's used in Worlds 2 through 6, the player can warp to World 5, 6, or 7. And if it's used in Worlds 7 through 8, or in the Warp Zone area itself, the player can then warp to World 8. Essentially, all you need to do is collect the first whistle, and then go on to World 2 and collect the second whistle, and use those first two whistles, and you'll get to level 8. Using the first and level 2, you can warp to 7, basically, and then use the last and 7 to get to 8. That's the best way of telling you how to do that. But anyway, why is it on my list? Let's just get to that, because I could keep going on. Super Mario Bros. 3 was, and still is in some form, the greatest platformer ever created. Especially, it definitely is in the 8-bit era. The overworld map gave a perception of depth to the game by spreading the levels out over each world. The graphics popped, and the sprites were crisp and bold. And how about them sprites in Giantland? Man, back in the day, 13-year-old me and all my friends, that was mind-blowing, seeing those gigantic characters. It's so iconic, it just blew you away back then. The controls are nice and tight. The music is fantastic. This felt like a true step forward in action platforming games that every action platforming game going forward took cues from. Like I stated earlier, this game took the formula of the original Super Mario Bros., and they worked it, and they put their thing down, and they flipped it and reversed it, and spit out quite the fucking gem of a Mario game. And giving our heroes the power of flight, and having the screen now scroll vertically as well, while simultaneously scrolling to the side, was just remarkable. And it made points or a score actually matter this time. In addition to the classic 1-up chain, which is stepping on a series of enemies, banking your points to collect the 1-ups, a spade card would appear on the world map for every 80,000 points earned, allowing the player to play a flip card matching game. Also, treasure ships are summoned through a trick that must be performed by hitting a certain combo with your ending score and ending coin count in a level. And it goes a little something like this. Hit it! The player must be in either World 1, World 3, or World 5, or World 6. And they also must have a wandering hammer brother on that world map. Okay? That's easy enough. Let's start with that. 1, 3, 5, 6, and hammer brother. Mario and Luigi must finish a stage with a coin total ending in multiple of 11. Zeros don't count. The 10th digit of a player score must be in multiples of 11. So, for example, if the coin total is 11, the 10th digit must be a 1. That's the best way I can put it. So if the coin total is 22, then the 10th digit must be a 2, and so on. As each second left on the timer will be awarded the player 50 points, the timer must be stopped on an even number so that the number of points received is a multiple of 100. Alternatively, an odd number will work if the score is 50 points off from the correct multiple. Okay, so for instance, if the above criteria are met, and the player ends a stage with 44 coins and a score of, say, 246,240, they will successfully trigger the treasure ship. These kinds of secrets were awesome for gaming at the time, because you're triggering an event, and then when you did, you're like, what the fuck is this? Like, how the fuck did I just do this? As opposed to finding secrets within a level, how you play throughout a level reveals a secret on the overworld map, which was mind-blowing. Power-ups are what make the game. All the suits and what they do and how they help you. Not only was it cool to see the brothers transform beyond having the power of fire, but being able to bank them throughout the game as well for use before going into a level really made the player take note that, you know, if you fail a level, but say like it's a water level and you know the frog suit's going to help you traverse the waters, you can go back in that level having selected the frog suit before you do, and it made players want to play as smart as possible. Anyway, I could keep gushing. I really could, but let's just take this all and roll it up into a nice big reason as to why Super Mario Bros. 3 is my number one NES game. Anyway, that petition rotation, people, is my list of top 7 NES games. Before we go, it's time for a little segment I like to call the Poda Rota Player's Pro Tip of the Day.
Oh, yeah.
This is where I take one game on my list and give you a pro tip for playing the game you may not know about. These could be cheats, they could be Easter eggs, or I could tell you something completely unnecessary, since that is what the phrase pro tip was created for, to follow up with some kind of bullshit. So what's it going to be today? I'm going to give you an actual gameplay tip for Bionic Commando. Did you know you already have infinite continues at your disposal? When the game is over, just press A and nothing else, and you'll start on the same level you died on. I mean, I guess if you already are one of those gamers that press A, like a controller has no other buttons and like A is your input for everything, and that's just all you do by default is press A, I mean, then you already know this. And you probably already figured it out, and this makes it a pointless tip for you, but that's all you get. I'm not giving you another one. And that was the Poda Rota Player's Pro Tip of the Day. So, thanks for joining me on this very first episode of my podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I did flailing my way through it. Do you have any comments for me or want to share your thoughts? I would be more than willing to share them on a future episode. You can email me at potationrotation@gmail.com. You can also visit potationrotation.com, and there you will find all the links on our homepage to all of our YouTube content. Again, find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook as well. And keep a listen for the next episode. If you follow on the socials, you'll get notified of when that'll be. As of right now, there's 2 episodes a month. And I also hope to have some guests on some of them as well going forward. As of now, that's going to be it, folks. I'm going to go brew up the next episode, ranking the top 7 RPG characters. Until then, I'll see you later.